This is the State of Things from the North Carolina Museum of Natural Sciences. I'm Frank Stachow. He was named for the famous European composer who wrote this. But here's the piece that turned him on to music. When Bela Fleck heard Earl Scruggs picking the theme to the Beverly Hillbillies, he was hooked. A lot has happened since he got his first banjo at the age of 15. He's collaborated with a diverse range of musicians from all over the world to create sounds that no one knew were possible from a banjo. And he's picked up 15 Grammy Awards along the way. He and his wife, Abigail Washburn, are about to release a new CD. It's out this week, and it's later next week. It's called Simply Enough, Bela Fleck and Abigail Washburn, and they are among the luminaries here in Raleigh this week for the International Bluegrass Music Association's annual convention. In fact, Bela Fleck was the keynote speaker this year, and he joins me now on the State of Things. Bela Fleck, good to have you here.
Good to be here.
Tell me about that first. I hear there's a great story about your first banjo at 15 years old.
Well, my grandfather got me my first banjo. I got bit by the banjo bug after hearing Earl Scruggs playing what we just heard. And it seems that if you're going to be a banjo player, it's almost always Earl Scruggs who activates you. And so I was activated by Earl Scruggs by that sound, but I never had the nerve to think I would actually be able to play one. You know, so I never thought, oh, I'm going to go play the banjo. I was just like, wow, I love that. What an incredible thing. And then this banjo just showed up when I was 15. So that was the cool part. My grandfather got it because I'd been screwing around with the guitar a bit at that point. Kind of in a, you know, not super seriously, but I liked it. But when I got the banjo, it was a whole different thing because I got extremely serious about it. And right when I started high school.
But it's one thing to listen to that song. You can't just listen over and over again and suddenly become a great player. I understand that you got your first at least hint about instruction on a subway ride. Am I right?
Well, on the train coming from my grandparents' place back to New York City was about an hour-long ride from Peekskill. And there was a fellow that was on the train who was a folk musician. You know, remember this was the early 70s. There were some folk musicians left around. And he said, hey, can you play that banjo? And I said, no. And he said, can you tune that banjo? I said, no. And he said, I'll tune it for you. And he tuned it up for me and gave it back to me and showed me a couple little things on the train ride home. So that was some serendipity right there, too.
I like the fact that those folk singers were still riding trains.
Yeah.
I think that's all kind of cool, too.
Mm-hmm.
You released your first album in 1979. Soon after that, you joined the Newgrass Revival, which was kind of a game changer for the entire industry. I mean, talk about that. Was that something that you had intended to do from the start? You know, because it's a traditional music, but you were moving it in new directions right from the start of your career. Really.
Well, I had this thing going on, which is that I was not from a cabin home on the hill. I was from 100th Street and West End Avenue. That's where I was when I was, you know, first playing the banjo, and that's what my influences were, the influences of a New York City kid who was a teenager in the very early 70s. So I heard everything. I listened to all kinds of music. It was just weird that I happened to love bluegrass the best, and when I got the banjo, that became my full-time obsession. But at the same time, I was hearing jazz. I was hearing classical music. It was all around me in New York. So, and I thought that the musicians that were really hip were the ones that changed their music. I mean, even starting with the Beatles, every record was different until suddenly, you know, they imploded. But that was what we considered the arc of a great musical career, is someone who continually pushed himself and grew. So I figured, wow, the banjo can be my frontier. You know, I'll just keep trying to do cool things on the banjo. Right from the beginning, I was excited about that.
Were you excited about music right away? And it's one thing to imagine hearing that song and saying, what's going on there? How do I do that?
Right.
But were you already interested in music?
Well, certain things would really turn me on. And once I started playing the banjo seriously, I got really into trying to figure out how music worked through the banjo, because I didn't play these other instruments. I couldn't play a piano. I couldn't read music. My guitar playing was very rudimentary. So the banjo quickly became my identity and then the lens through which I tried to understand all music.
But that's interesting because the songbook for banjo was mostly country and kind of bluegrass tunes or traditional tunes. So was that what you were listening to at first?
Yeah, I mean, you have to really, if you get to know the bluegrass world, you see that people have been monkeying with stuff on the banjo since Earl Scruggs. Well, since before Earl Scruggs. From the, you know, way back in the late 1800s and early 1900s, people were arguing about what music was appropriate and inappropriate to play on the banjo because, you know, had the minstrel music, which was the imitation of the slave music. But then you also had people taking that instrument and trying to play light classical music or the early jazz on all these different things. So for me, it was pretty natural.
And were you trying to adapt it right from the start? In other words, were you getting away from the country sound and trying to see, hey, well, can I play jazz on this? Can I play classical music?
Well, first I wanted to play like Earl Scruggs, and I wanted just to be able to play fast and play bluegrass and be part of that music, you know, be able to make that sound. And then, but then all around me, everything else was interesting. When I was in high school, I realized that if I could play the opening to Stairway to Heaven, that got a lot more attention than me playing dueling banjos. You know, so, yeah.
Did you actually do that in high school? You played Stairway to Heaven on the banjo?
Well, just the introduction.
That's really all you need to get the attention you want. Well, will you play a song for us now?
I hope I will. Let's see what happens.
All right.
Let's see. I'll play something, and then we'll talk about whatever it is that I did.
Perfect. Thank you. Bela Fleck on the State of Things, keynote speaker at IBMA here in Raleigh, also out with a new album with his wife and collaborator Abigail Washburn, called simply enough Bela Fleck and Abigail Washburn, due for release October 7th, though I guess there's a pre-release here at the convention, right?
That's right.
Very cool. So now that tune, we said we could talk about it. I can't say I can name it, but I heard some familiar bits of music embedded in that.
Like a lot of times when I start playing, I just start playing and then see what happens. And then as I become afraid that I don't know how I'm going to land it, I'll go into something that I know. But if I'm not performing in front of people, I might go for quite a while before I become afraid. So in this case, I played whatever I felt like for a while. And then I went into a tune called Sunset Road that was on the Flecktones, I guess our first CD.
Yeah. So, and is that how you compose? Do you write music that way?
A lot of times. It's interesting because there's things that you can do when you're improvising that you cannot do when you're composing, and there are things that you can do composing that you cannot do when you're improvising. And so there are things that occur as you just go along in a stream of consciousness that would be very hard to conceptualize without the instrument in your hand and that moment in front of you. So I try to enjoy both processes.
Are they completely different? Is there a kind of a logic, a sort of mathematical logic, if I may, that applies to composition where you say, you know, that's part of that D chord. I could then take the tonic and go to the left. Because I don't write music, so I just made that up.
Yeah. Well, going to the tonic and going to the left sounds like a good idea to me. You know, I'm comfortable with that. But I would say that some people say that composing is improvising in slow motion. Because you have time to go back and go, I take that back. I'm going to change that line. Yeah. I'm going to, well, what if I, oh, now that I'm thinking about it, I have a spare finger. I could actually play some other notes at the same time. Or maybe the harmony isn't as cool as I thought. Maybe I could apply some different ideas halfway through. But meanwhile, you know, you come up with a basic theme pretty quickly usually.
Slow motion, but a different kind of kinesthetics if you think about the logic, maybe, that where you can think logically about where notes belong, any of the theory that you happen to know, that's a kind of motion.
But ironically, the things that happen spontaneously sometimes are even better examples of theory or things that you don't realize that you knew that can only occur when you're in a stream of consciousness state. So, you know, there's things to be gained from both. They're both wonderful ways to play music.
Let's talk about the trajectory of your career. Your first Grammy nomination in 1988 for Drive. Is that when you started to think about stepping away from bluegrass?
Actually, Drive, this is actually interesting, I suppose. Drive followed some very progressive records that I was trying to do. I was in Newgrass Revival, and I had a presence on the bluegrass scene at that point. And I was trying to do with my own things. When I got to do a solo record, I was trying to look for things that were new to me and new to the banjo. And I think I did an album called Deviation before that. And at the time, I was trying to think, well, now what am I going to do next? And I thought, you know, I really would love to do a record with Sam Bush and Tony Rice and Jerry Douglas and Stuart Duncan and Mark O'Connor and Mark Schatz. I really need to do that, especially after playing on a recording with Tony Rice called Cold on the Shoulder, where I got to be in that rhythm section with Sam and Sam Bush and Tony Rice and Jerry Douglas, and Vassar was on that stuff. And I thought, wow, what a great band this would be to play some of my tunes. And so I actually thought, I want to do something a little more in the bluegrass vein. And so that was a step into that before I actually cut the tether completely with the Flecktones and really started going way out.
And talk about that. I understand that you got a fairly interesting phone call from a guy named Victor Wooten.
That's right. Yes, I got a call from a guy. I had been in Newgrass Revival for probably 6 years out of my eight, and he played the bass over the phone for me, and it was incredible. And I remember thinking, well, that's pretty incredible, but what does it have to do with me? but I said, come on over and let's play a little bit. You know, I happened to be in Nashville. He had seen a Newgrass Revival video, and he met somebody who I knew, and we were introduced, and we sat around and played, and we had this just amazing little jam, like a couple of hours of just playing spontaneously that we never ran out of stuff to play. So I thought about him. That nagged at me from then on that this guy existed.
What did you think he had to do with you? I mean, you were wondering why he called you, but what was it that he heard in you? Because you had been doing mostly, playing with Vassar Clements and Tony Rice, so associated with the Newgrass Revival, and here's a guy who's got some improvisational jazz chops that, you know, out the window.
Right.
So what did he hear? Why did he call you?
I think because he was doing a lot of things with his right hand that were unique, and so he was a little bit curious about how the banjo played all those super fast notes, because that was one of the things that he was developing, was all of these ways to play these rippling arpeggios, mostly with the two-hand tapping technique, but sometimes with a combination of open strings and hammer-ons and pull-offs, mm-hmm. which is a lot of how we do banjo stuff.
Would you do that for me? Do a hammer-on and do a pull-off, just to demonstrate that.
A hammer-on would be... and a pull-off would be... But for instance, if you wanted to go, you could either play every note, or you could go and pulling off every other note, which means you're actually plucking half the notes. And you could go a lot faster once you start introducing these other techniques in, because you're not having to play every single note with your right hand.
With your right hand, because that hand that's up there on the fret is actually pulling the string and making a sound. So now both notes, both hands are actually making melody notes.
Which honestly is a lot of the Scrugg style. It's not...
That's the magic.
Hammer, hammer, pull. So that's a lot of it. It's a lot of hammers and pulls in bluegrass, and it's a great part of the banjo sound.
Yeah, which gives it that magic quality. It's like, how many hands does that guy have? How many strings are on that thing?
And then you hear the notes cascading into each other, and it really sounds like more than one person. Yeah.
And it's a remarkable sound, and I think something that – because you can do that on a guitar. You can do it on a bass, clearly. But when you do it on a banjo, that's when it seems to me the overtones and all the rest of it become kind of magic.
It's almost like you have a little piano in your hands, and you can step on a hold pedal on the piano, and all the notes will just ring into each other. And there's registers in the banjo little magical pockets where the notes just and it's just all ringing like as if you were holding down the pedal on the piano. So that's a fun part of playing the banjo.
It is a fun part of listening to the banjo. The new record now that you and Abigail have put out, it takes you back a little bit to your roots, isn't it? There's some real traditional sound on there.
It does. I mean, I would say it's the first record I've been involved in probably since 1996 that really fits this whole acoustic world, this bluegrass acoustic world that I was in for so long and I kind of taken a long sabbatical from.
Well, we're going to hear a little bit of it. We're going to take a break. My guest, Bela Fleck, we're talking today from Raleigh, part of the IBMA. We're here for the International Bluegrass Music Association annual convention. Bela Fleck was the keynote speaker and my guest now. And we're going to listen to a cut from his latest album with wife Abigail Washburn. This is a cut called Am I Born to Die? We're going to take a break and let you listen to that. We'll be right back with Bela Fleck. Stay tuned.
And am I born to die, to lay this body down, and must my trembling spirit fly into a world unknown? Soon as from earth I go, what will become of me? Eternal happiness or woe? What shall my portion be? Thank you.
This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stasio. Bela Fleck is my guest. The 15-time Grammy Award winner is here in North Carolina for the IBMA convention, where he gave a keynote address earlier this week. And we are here in Raleigh enjoying the festivities. We talked about your foray into jazz, meeting Victor Wooten and working with him and the Flecktones. Was that a sort of a natural evolution? Were you headed there anyway, or did you sort of have to make a kind of conscious break? I've got to get out of this. I've got to get into something else.
It was what I really was excited about. I didn't know if I had the, you know, ability I didn't know if I could have the ability to really be a jazz musician, but I really wanted to try, and I wanted to be involved in a lot of different kinds of musics, and the Flecktones was a window for me. I had tried before, like while I was in Newgrass Revival, I had a couple other kind of part-time bands that would get together and rehearse up a bunch of my tunes, like with drums and vibes and percussion and things like that. But they really just weren't good enough to do something like this. I really have always felt that with instrumental music, you've got everything against you, and it can't really be one guy in a backup band. Of course, Kenny G might look at it differently. It's worked out very well for him. But in my case, with playing the banjo, I felt like I wanted to be in a band where I needed a band where every single person was an equal and a powerhouse, kind of like the early days of the David Grisman Quintet. In fact, a lot of his years were – it wasn't just him. He also had Tony Rice. He had Daryl Langer. He had Mark O'Connor. He had all these wonderful players that came through. And so the music wasn't all relying on – it wasn't like mandolin with a backup band. It was a band. And that's one of the things I learned from bluegrass that I wanted to have in a band that I had. And so when I met Victor Wooten and I met Howard Levy and I met Future Man, I thought, well, these are all stars. These guys are all so powerful that if people get to see a band with the four of us in it, it's going to be really interesting for people. It'll suck some people in long enough for them to give us a good listen, basically. Because it sounds like a novelty act. Like you've got a banjo, a harmonica, a funk bass, and then you've got like a drum machine, guitar, drum thing. The great thing about our weird instrumental lineup is that you got to watch it for a little while and sort of try to figure out what's going on.
Well, how about you as a composer, as a writer, and a performer? Did you have to figure out what was going on?
Well, I wanted to work with people I could learn a lot from. Yeah. So, but I had the big card, which was, for one thing, I was the one person in the band who kind of had a career already, like a pretty significant career. I had a following and I had a record deal, and I had a bunch of music I had written that was waiting for a home. So because I could be the leader in terms of those things, the parts of the music that I couldn't play yet were not a problem because the guys were flexible about it, and I could learn from them. And they were learning from me too. So I could teach them things about bluegrass or about the kinds of things that the banjo did.
Well, you talked about the upside of having a career and a name already and a following. The downside is you've got a name and a career and a following, and you're about to go another way, right? Is that scary?
Yeah. I didn't have – I guess you could say I had a lot to lose. I mean, but I just needed to do it. Now, another aspect of this thing which was true – is that Newgrass Revival was really struggling with this identity crisis where we were this progressive band that would go out and jam for 3 hours, you know, in clubs and just tear it up. But we were trying to make it in country music. And that was becoming very disheartening for me because, like, I was a little younger than the other guys. I was ready for a good fight to go play, you know, idiosyncratic personal music and, you know, fight windmills. But the other guys were in a little different place. Like, they liked to do that too, but they also – wanted to see us get on the record, on the charts, you know. But country music didn't like the banjo at that time. So I always felt like I had my arms tied back behind me on all the new music we were working on.
You actually got into a little bit of a fight with the IBMA when they gave you an award for bluegrass and you wanted to make it clear to them that you had moved on.
Yeah, I regret that very much. I didn't handle that very well. What happened was the first year of the IBMA, I was the first winner of the banjo award. And 1990 is the year that the Flecktones became a full-time band. And I had been fighting a lot of tough fights with Warner Brothers because now that they'd signed me on the jazz department, all they wanted to do was put our records in the country bins and the bluegrass bins. And I was like, I didn't leave that music to go – to play jazz or whatever it is we do, to have it end up in the bluegrass bin. So I had a little bit of a chip on my shoulder around that time. And, you know, there was still a lot of negative energy around the banjo stereotypes that I was a little – but I still didn't handle it well. And what I did is I got on stage and I said, thank you for this award. I have to say I didn't play any bluegrass in 1990. I'll try to do it in the future. That's not the way to do it. But it, you know, I was leaving bluegrass then. I was on my move out, and I was a foolish youngster. And I'm glad I got to talk about that a little bit on in my keynote and point out that bluegrass is such a big part of me. It's a big part of even the Flecktones, in that as the leader of the group, I pushed a lot of bluegrass ideology on everybody about the way the music needed to feel. The music all had to have that forward lean and that push.
I was going to say, what is that feel and how is that different from an improvisational jazz?
We call it drive in bluegrass. You know, that's one of the things. Has it got that drive? Does it click along a certain way? And a lot of times there's a lot of different kinds of jazz, for one thing. And there's jazz that's very lazy and jabba-doo-doo-shwee-bee-ba-la-doo-bang, you know. I didn't want to do anything that sounded like that. I wanted to do the kind of jazz that was clicking along and pushing towards the edge, like some of the jazz that I really liked. And Chick Corea was a real a guy whose music always pushed. He always pushed with his piano parts. And Pat Martino was a guy who always grooved hard and with a certain edge. It's almost like it feels like it's speeding up, but it might be a little bit, but it really hardly is. It just everyone's playing on the front end of the beat. And as a banjo player, I'm kind of a percussionist. I have notes, but I also have percussion to every note. So I'm very aware of the chromosomes of feel. You know, how does this music feel?
Well, I guess it's different. The difference between running and walking fast, right? I mean, when you're running, you're literally falling. Is it that sort of thing?
It is.
Or literally, if you don't put that next foot down, you're going to fall.
Well, we talk about in bluegrass, like we'll talk about, did we get that floating feeling? Like in a good bluegrass band, it feels like nobody is working. It's just we're just all floating along, but we're moving forward with a certain – it's a beautiful feeling. Yeah.
Can I get you to play something now?
Okay. Let me play something now. I think I'm going to play something from this banjo concerto that I wrote a couple of years ago and some music from the second movement of that. Thank you.
Bela Fleck on the State of Things. We're in Raleigh for the IBMA convention. That is the second movement of a banjo concerto that he wrote a couple years ago?
Yeah, maybe 3 years ago now. Time is floating by.
Did you study classical composition?
I did not. A lot of it was carefully worked over till I developed each section, but I looked for the things that the banjo could do well. Like, the banjo ripples really well, so if I do something like... I'm using the open strings on the high. One of the neat things about the banjo, if I can indulge for a second about the banjo, it's tuned to an open G chord, right? So that's cool, but we're stuck in G, and usually we hear... Great, awesome, but it sounds like bluegrass, right? But what happens if you go to a different key but use those notes from the G chord against a different tonality? Then you can get something like, maybe something like... I'm playing in the key of F, but I'm using all these G chords. Or even in F sharp. So you can clearly hear the F sharp chord, but you can also clearly hear the G chord.
Which is like finding the tonic and turning left.
Yes, exactly. So I think that's one of the fun things about this very
it's an amazing,
bizarre tuning.
I had never thought about it. That is kind of cool.
Yeah.
But knowing that you can do that, that's when you have to decide you're going to break away from the sound that everybody knows and ask yourself, what can this instrument do?
I'm just looking for the sounds that turn me on. You know, and the more that I play, the more I can put my hand down somewhere and maybe here, nice bluegrass chord. Go change one note, change another note. Change another note. Now I'm a half step higher, but I've still got the G sound, so that's the fun for me. I just move my fingers around, but it does get intuitive after a while. It's not just moving your fingers around, because you start to know what you're going to hear when you move your finger, and then you have to figure out how to justify it. Once you do move your finger, now what am I going to do? And when I get lucky, I can find a long path of natural motions that take me on a journey, and that's what I'm always kind of looking to do.
Another lucky find was your wife, Abigail, and a great story. Tell us about how you met.
I met Abby at the only square dance I've ever gone in Nashville. I lived there since 1981, and I went to one square dance to play in the band with Russ Barenberg, and I saw her dancing there on the floor, and I was like, wow. And it took us a while to get together because we were both in different situations, different lives back then, but eventually it happened, and I became a real fan of her as a person first, and then I was thrilled to fall in love with her music too. And she's done some wonderful records, and she played with the Uncle Earl, which is a great girl, old time band first, girl band second, because they're just a great band. But they really tore up the festival circuit, and then she moved off into her own things, and she's she has a great TED Talk. She did a great commencement speech for the Colorado College. And
well, we're going to hear a song. And in fact, again, this takes you back to your roots, and it's a very cool album that you've put together. This one's got a little bit of a political edge that we're going to play next. What you going to do, huh? Talking a little bit about global warming.
Yeah, well, now, Abby is a great songwriter. I mean, a really great poetic songwriter. This is the one song, maybe, I'm not going to say ever, but one of the few songs I've ever written. And I wrote it just I guess after the Flecktones played in Indonesia way back in the mid 90s, and we were in Banda Aceh where the tsunami hit and devastation occurred. And so I was thinking about, you know, what are you going to do? Like, there's nothing you can do when a 30-foot wave sweeps over your town or your life and destroys it. But the situation that we're all in with global warming, which it makes a lot more sense to believe, to take seriously than to assume that it's a plot by somebody. Because if you're wrong and it is for real, well, we better be figuring it out. So I was thinking about that for everybody.
Well, great to talk with you. We're going to go out and listen to that song as we close our show. But what a pleasure. So great to talk with you, Bela Fleck.
My pleasure. Thank you very much.
Bela Fleck, banjo virtuoso, played with countless bluegrass legends and is about to release a new album of duets with his wife, Abigail Washburn. It's called Bela Fleck and Abigail Washburn. It comes out October 7th. This is North Carolina Public Radio. It's a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. And we'll play What You Gonna Do from their new album. Thank you.
gonna do, what you gonna do, what you gonna do, what you gonna do when the land goes.